A grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Prairie Ensemble, which presents Stravinsky's Complete Pulcinella Ballet, featuring dancers from the University of Illinois, on Friday, May 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. Also included are works by Granville Bantock, Francis Poulenc, and Joan Tower. Tickets and information available at 355-9077 or on the web at prairieensemble.org.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. Just a quick mention of tomorrow, in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk with Micah Sifry. He is senior analyst at Public Campaign, a former editor of The Nation magazine, and we will be talking about third-party politics in America. That's the subject of a book that he authored titled Spoiling for a Fight. That was published a couple of years ago. It's now out in a paperback edition, and we will talk with him a little bit about the difficulties of challenging the dominance of the Democratic and Republican parties in this country. That'll be hour number one. Hour two, the guest is Locke Johnson. He's Regents Professor of Political Science at University of Georgia. We'll be talking about strategic intelligence, and that'll be in hour number two. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with artist Carrie Mae Weems. She is one of the best known and most honored artists of her generation. She is a photographer, primarily, but saying that gives you a limited idea of what it is she does. If you're not familiar with her work, it has been anthologized. She was here to give a talk on the U of I campus yesterday, so some people certainly will know about her. And if not, you can go out and you can see her work. It is available, published in books. She has been her work has been shown all over the country in one-person shows and in shows with other artists. She's done also a lot of teaching and talking about her work. It all, one way or another, deals with issues of race and racism and of the African-American experience, both using archival images and her own photographs. And I'm very pleased that she'd be here and talk a little bit about herself and her work. And as we talk, as always, questions from people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being
here. You're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
You have been a photographer, have been taking pictures for a long time now.
For a long time.
What is it that about the photograph that you find appealing?
It's so immediate. It's immediacy. It's extraordinary ability to underscore the moment. I think, as Cartier-Bresson said, to record the decisive moment. But there's something about the immediacy and about the world photographed that interests me very much, this ability to take a slice of life and to pinpoint it, to articulate it, to give it a certain kind of volume, to elevate the everyday. Mm-hmm. That interests me very much. And so photography immediately became my muse, my little guide.
You mentioned Cartier-Bresson. The thing that always strikes me about his pictures when I look at them is that they both seem beautifully composed and also candid. I don't know how it is you do that. I guess he knew how to do that. And I think I see that in your photographs too, actually.
You know, Bresson is a very interesting character because as much as he was very much interested in documentary photography and as much as we think of him as a documentarian, in mm-hmm. fact, he really wasn't. He really was a man who composed a great many of his photographs. I compose a great many of my photographs. And like Bresson, I take hundreds and hundreds of photographs trying to organize the world in a certain kind of way. So in some ways, you know, we talk about photographs as being true, but I actually think of them more as being articulating a certain kind of truth that is organized and orchestrated by the will of the photographer.
I think that that's something that we forget about photography, because you see the one image a photographer has chosen that does everything that he or she hopes you can do,
and
you don't see the hundred, you don't see all the others that they printed and looked at and thought, eh, and they threw down on the floor in the dark room.
But you know, there's this really great story about another one of my favorite photographers. I have many, but Roy DiCaravo, who was one of the great photographers of America, and also Eugene Smith, and. One day, a friend of mine who was working for Life magazine went into the office. It was Christmas. He was falling out with his wife. It was sure that they were going to be divorcing anytime soon. And he decided that he just had to get out of the house on Christmas morning. And he goes into Life magazine office early, early in the morning, maybe about 8 o'clock. And he's there until about 10 o'clock at night, thinking that he was the only person, of course, working in the building on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. About 10 o'clock, Eugene Smith, great photographer, stumbles out of the dark room, and he looks at John and he says, "Ah, John, hi. Look, I'm glad to see you. Come on into the dark room. I want to ask your advice on something." And so John Fruits gets up and he walks into the dark room. And Life's dark room was huge. I mean, you know, it was the dark room of major photographers. They walk into the dark room, and from floor to ceiling, are hundreds of photographs, all of the same print, printed differently. And Eugene Smith looked at him after a few minutes and he said, "Which one do you like best?"
Yeah.
The art of photography.
Yeah.
The art of making, of composing, and knowing that, you know, anything can be manipulated in the darkroom.
Yeah. And of course, not with today's digital technologies, there seems to be almost no limit to what you can do, which gets us into some real questioning about this feeling that we've had for such a long time that a photograph is true. Right?
Well, you know, there is this idea again that a photograph is true, like there is the idea that a photograph is worth 1,000 words. But as a friend asked me one day when I was deeply interested in documentary photography and about to make some changes, he said, "Well, which 1,000 are you talking about specifically?" What is the truth that you're talking about specifically? And so I think that the thing that's important about understanding photographs is that they articulate a truth. Not necessarily that they are true, but that they articulate a truth. And that's different. Mm-hmm. And that is perhaps for the greatest photographs, their very special power, that they elevate us, they move us to something closer to our human need to know and our desire to understand something more profoundly. Art, photographs, painting, dance, music can help us in that way to illuminate the depths of human desire.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580 photographer Carrie Mae Weems. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. What do you want your art to do?
That's probably changed over the years. You know, when you're younger, you think that you'll change the world through what you make, your intervention. I'm very much interested in ideas of illumination, of revealing emotions, revealing deeper understanding, complex meaning. I want them to be the source of beauty and inspiration. I want them to sing. I want them to make you cry. I want them to make you feel something that you have always felt but weren't quite sure of how to talk about or describe. Like when I read something great by Toni Morrison or 100 Years of Solitude, you know, those sort of great, great, great books of our time that completely elevate your emotional understanding of what's possible. And so while I don't view myself as being a great artist by any means, I think that to a certain extent, some of the work is important in that it allows for an opening of dialogue and discussion around a number of complex issues, whether they are aesthetic issues or issues of cultural, social importance. Though I have to differ with you in saying that I don't think about my work as being about race. I think I talked about this actually a little bit yesterday in the talk. I think it's much more about the complicated relationships that that humanity is trying to balance for itself. And so while it might not be about race, it certainly can be about racism sometimes and occasionally. But that's not really the main thrust of the work.
I guess one of the ideas or one of the things that I'm struck by when I have read some of the things you've said and some of the things that other people have said about your work is that you want both for it to say something. You want it to be provocative. You want it to make people think, but you also want it to be beautiful.
I'm a real, I'm a real sucker for beauty. It's also the point of entry. You know, it's like a beautiful dress on a lovely woman or a great pair of earrings or something that's delicate. It allows entry. It's a point of entry. And so I use those sort of aesthetic term, that aesthetic term, the aesthetic term of beauty in that way. So it's not at all for beauty for beauty's sake or for its own sake, but rather for the ability to pull the audience into a space that it might not otherwise want to go, because the issues that I'm dealing with in the work are sometimes are rather complex and are not really the things that people are really rushing out to see on a lovely day. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So how do you get people to come to the work, to negotiate the work, to trust that there is something for them to be found in the work? And I think that in part, beauty is a thing that starts to get us there. It's like the cover of this book that we're looking at, the sort of beautiful, beautiful, beautiful black boy, blue black boy, sort of way of aestheticizing a problem, an issue. An issue, so yeah, I do it all the time, and I'm trying to do it better all the time. Though there is something about trying to beautify an ugly world that's really interesting. Trying to figure out the aesthetic range that's possible while we examine the sort of mess of our lives. But I suppose, like the great myths of the ancient world, I mean, they were dealing with these very complex issues and subjects of incest and violence and homosexuality and death and all, of course, in this sort of really beautiful, beautiful arena of the theater. And a profound sense of language and costume and gesture and light, but to deal with very, very complicated issues. And so to that extent, I'm really no different, I think, than a great number of artists.
Mm. You did a series of photographs, the Kitchen Table series, and this is something that I think some people will know and really kind of made you. It really established you. It was sort of the first really big thing that it caused people to, I think, take notice of you. And it's a series of photographs. They're all taken from the same perspective. That is, the viewer, it's like you're looking down a long table, and the people that are in the picture are at the other end. And there is a light that hangs over the table, and that appears to be the source of light in the picture. Now, actually, I think one of the things that strikes me about those pictures is the use of light and shadow. It just knocks me out. They're so wonderfully lit. Was the light over the table the only light that you used, or did you use other lights?
Do I have to tell you? Do I have to answer? Do I have to give away my secret?
Well, not if you don't want to.
Well, actually, Kitchen Table remains for me one of my favorite bodies of work, and I return to it again and again. And the interesting thing is that I have a very small house with very small walls, and I usually don't get a chance to engage or interact with my work unless it's hanging someplace. I see it in exhibition, and I think, oh, I made that. That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. What a wonderful thing. What a wonderful piece of work. And And somehow I happened to make that. What an extraordinary thing. But Kitchen Table was something that I worked on constantly over the course of maybe 4 or 5 months. I worked on it every single day. And arranging it, really trying to understand what I wanted the world to look like, how I wanted that room to feel, the ambiance, the mood, all of those things, I kept sort of chipping away at. And so, yes, I came up with this overall light of, I call it the light of interrogation, that spills across that table as this woman plays out a series of relationships between women and women, and women and men, and women and children, and women alone. It was a very, this light of interrogation spilling on that scene, or those scenes, scenarios, tableaus, was of real importance. But in order to get a kick of light, there was another, there was a small room just adjacent to the main room. And so I turned that on, and it just sort of gave me just tiny bit of fill in order to bounce into the other room. I also used a very, very, very slow shutter speed for those images too. So, but yeah, there's a key light, which is the main light in the picture, and then this sort of tiny light that's off to the side. Yeah, they're really beautiful.
They are really beautiful. They are really beautiful. And just trying to describe them doesn't do them justice. People have to go and see the pictures. And you are in all the pictures. Are you not?
Yes, I am. I started using myself, I've used myself off and on. I think of them as being rather performative, though I'm not really performing or acting out Carrie Mae Weems. She's really not the subject that I'm interested in. But I use my body in order to explore other ideas about, in order to empathize with other people and other situations. I use my own body to understand what it feels like to be placed in a particular situation. So I've been using myself for a long time in the Kitchen Table series and the recent work that I've done in Cuba, in Ritual and Revolution, in the Jefferson Suite, in the Hampton Project. Someplace the body of Carrie Mae Weems is always sort of interspersed in that work, leading the viewer really through the work. And I think I use her as a kind of muse, this physicality as a kind of muse to assist the audience in locating itself in her, so that you have, as the audience, you have a body to project on to that can carry the weight of the burden that you are interested in projecting, or, you know, the burden of your desire.
If you were taking a portrait, it seems to me that there are some photographs that I would say were portraits. You're taking a picture of another person. How do you think about that, approaching the idea of a portrait? And maybe that's really not the word that you would apply, but that's what it seems like to me.
Well, I've been interested in documentary portraiture for a long time, and I've made them. I started out making lots of documentary portraits, environmental portraits, rather. Mm-hmm. But I don't quite understand the gist of your question.
Well, I guess if you're thinking, okay, I have this person, say you're taking a picture of a person, and I have some idea of where I want to place them in terms of the setting and the background and the framing, and I don't know if you would say anything to them, if you tell them anything about what it is you're looking for, or you just say, "Here, just would you sit there, please?" And I'm wondering how you think about composing the image.
It's it depends. I don't make so many portraits at the moment. I've been doing in still photography. I've been doing more video and film recently, where I, of course, clearly direct the subject. But the same thing has been pretty much true also in the still photographs that I've made. When I was younger, again, under this idea of there being sort of this sort of objective truth about the photograph, then of course I made numerous environmental portraits sort of shot from the hip in that sort of way in which all the famous documentarians did. It was a way of working. And then I thought, well, I don't really like working this way. I mean, I really do like composing the world, and I like my subject understanding what it is that I'm after, and that this needs to be a collaboration between the sitter and the photographer in order to really make something dynamic happen. And so I'm much more involved now, of course, in asking, in engaging the subject, and assuming that we're working in collaboration, with me, of course, having the ultimate trump because I'm the photographer, yeah, after all.
So you're not doing as much things like, well, I think about the Georgia Sea Island series where you're photographing places and yeah, there are no people in there, so yeah, you're photographing yeah, objects and buildings and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess I'm also sort of interested in how you approach, how the difference in approach if you were going to take a picture of a person or if you were going to take a picture of that person's house, how you would think differently about what you're looking for, what you want to have in the picture.
Well, you know, it goes, I think, in some ways, it goes back to the first question that you asked, which has to do with photographic truth. For me, there are a couple of things that have to happen. First of all, I have to be absolutely honest with myself. I have to be absolutely honest with myself. And then I have to be absolutely honest with the sitter, that I'm not violating you, that I'm not taking something from you in a way that is exploitative and dismissive and using you for my own purpose. So I approach then a subject's home in the same way that I approach them, that I am looking for the integrity that is located there. What is the integrity here? Why am I looking here? What am I hoping to extract from this? Who do I need to show this to? For what reason am I making this image? Those are the kinds of questions that I'm asking myself endlessly, and they're very demanding questions. And again, at the end of the day, I have to sleep with me. Have I done right by this person? Have I done right by this situation? Have I been truthful in the way in which I have described the making of this image? Right, so that I'm not moving things around. I'm not placing trailers in places that they wouldn't be, or attempting to denigrate it in any kind of way. Mm-hmm. I'm not sneaking up on the subject. I'm not interested in sneaking. I'm interested in having them know that I'm there and that I'm asking for a certain amount of permission to use their image in a way that they would appreciate. And that's very important to me. It's one of the reasons that I think I moved away from documentary photography earlier, because there was something about it that was somewhat pejorative, and that it had to do with running out into the world and capturing the ethnic image and then bringing it back as a kind of trophy. I had to reject that. I didn't like that idea at all, and I didn't want to participate as an artist in that way. There had to be another way of having a conversation and including images, certain of people in a dialogue that would be representative of them and respectful of them at the same time. I was actually looking at a photograph this morning in the newspaper. Really, really upsetting, really disturbing. It's an image of Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown. And The caption reads something like, you know, both of them are really trying to get it together and sort of pull their lives together. But the photograph, of course, completely undercuts them. Bobby is this sort of drugged out, horrible thing. And Whitney is just this sort of, you know, smiling Barbie. It was just so weird. The power of the image, mm-hmm, you know, riding against the text.
Well, and that's something that we really haven't talked about, that you also use a lot in your work, combining images and text. So I said back at the beginning, I said, well, if you're a photographer, well, yes, you're a photographer, but there's more to what you do than then photography, and part is taking image and text and putting those two things together in a way that creates something that is more than just the, you know, more than the proverbial sum of the parts.
No, you know, I'm a terrible writer. I'm a really bad writer, but I keep doing it anyway. I mean, I don't, you know, I just keep going. And so, yes, I've been playing with language and words for a very, very long time and using them in association with photographs. So, as I said yesterday in the lecture, sometimes the text is on plate. Sometimes they're on rugs. Sometimes they're floating up above the photographs on silken banners. Sometimes they are imprinted in the photograph. Sometimes they're under the photograph on mats. I mean, so I've played with a number of different strategies for placing text in relationship to images. Hopefully, always engaging them both, so that in fact, I think one could, for instance, like in Kitchen Table, you could in fact simply read the story of Kitchen Table, and you would walk away with a very particular and very concise short story about a man, about a woman trying to figure out their relationship in a, you know, in a world that claims to be monogamous but isn't, you know, one that, you know, claims to embrace the nuclear family but doesn't. Yeah, so on the one hand you can do that, and on the other you could simply just deal with the photographs as interesting photographs that appear in relationship with one another as diptychs and triptychs and sometimes single panels as well. So the idea of building installation using sound and image and text has been an ongoing issue, and I've been working in this way for about 15 years. More recently, I decided that it would be much more interesting for me to begin to use aspects of my own voice and working with various composers in order to really begin to orchestrate sound, so that I started building room installations, room environments that no longer incorporated text in the way that I had been doing it for the last 15 years, but simply using the voice as the textural element to activate space and to activate the room. And again, sometimes pushing against what you see, you know, what is the relationship, always examining the relationship between the image and the sound and the text. That tension is something that I'm very much interested in.
Hmm. We're about midway through here. Our guest is Carrie Mae Weems. She's a photographer. Her work is very well known. She's shown all over the country. She has taught at many universities. There are collections of her work if you're interested in seeing it. She's here visiting the campus, gave a talk yesterday in the MillerCom series. It's the last one for this semester, and we're pleased that she could be here talking with us. And if you have questions or comments, you should feel free to call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have someone to talk with in Urbana, right here on our line number one.
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Ms. Weems, I'm curious about you. I heard your talk yesterday, which was wonderful, and you mentioned photographers that you were, you know, very much influenced by, and I've been very interested in the work of P.H. Polk for a long time, especially his series called Old Characters.
Oh, yes, I love that book.
Yeah, but I wondered what you thought about it, because his work, in some ways, just listening to your talk yesterday, it reminds me of your work in that he was documenting a series of black rural people living in Alabama, and
yes, I
and
know.
They each seem to tell a story. Mm-hmm. But I mean, what I was really trying to get at is that sometimes he left them untitled, and sometimes he gave them names like the pipe smoker and things like that,
or the boss.
Yes, that one especially. That's my favorite.
But, you know, actually the name of that series, it's called The Vanishing Negro.
Oh, it is.
It's called The Vanishing Negro.
Oh, okay.
And when I was a young girl, which was not terribly long ago, I had the pleasure, I decided that it was very important to, like, do a series of interviews with photographers around the country.
Okay.
And so somehow or another, I convinced somebody to give me some money so I could jump on a train or a bus or whatever and go visit people. And one of the people I went to visit was P.H. Polk in Alabama.
Oh, wonderful.
And spent this amazing week with him doing a series of interviews and talking to him about what he was trying to do as an artist and why he thought it was so important to do this series of photographs, and was deeply moved by him, and very much respected what he was trying to do. So when I sat with him to talk to him about this book, Vanishing Negro, he said, you know, I was sitting in my house and I saw this woman coming down the street, the boss. I saw her coming down the street and I said to myself that this way of life is changing. And in another 20 years, there will be no more evidence of this. I have to make a record. And so he ran outside, literally, and dragged this woman back into his house, back into his studio, and composed her. He said, okay, now what I want you to do is, you know, I want you to turn this way, I want you to look this way, and I want you to put your hands on your hips. And he made that great, great photograph, which hangs in my kitchen.
Yeah, I've got one in mine, too.
Do you really? That's great. Yeah, he was very important to me. And Roy DiCarava, as I mentioned earlier, was very important to me. And Robert Frank was very important to me.
Mm-hmm. But, Jules, you know, I just have to comment with one quick comment, and that is,
yes.
I think he may have done a little damage by calling her the boss and making her, you know, because that image is everywhere. And unfortunately, I think people have, that's one of the many stereotypes of Southern black women, you know. And I, in a way, it's true, and I accept it, and I think about it a lot. But on the other hand, it's like he has emblazoned that permanent image in everybody's imagination. And it's something black women have to struggle against, you know, I think. Some of us do.
Well, you know, that woman looks like my grandmother.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I embrace it.
Okay.
I'm not really worried about, you know, it's a very interesting question that you've raised, because I don't think of it, frankly, as being a stereotypic image. Mm-hmm. I do think that that it is an archetypal image, mm-hmm. and that he has elevated her to almost a mythic figure, mm-hmm. one who walks with the giants, mm-hmm. a woman who hopefully can be in control as much as possible, in control of her life. And so for me, what he does is to elevate the black female subject, as opposed to giving us yet another kind of Aunt Jemima stereotype,
right.
that weakens her.
Right.
And so I think that the people that think of her as being stereotypic have a very, very limited understanding of what stereotypes are.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly what, you know, you can also look at it this way, that there are both negative and positive stereotypes as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a show of Carl Van Vechten's work at the Art Institute, and the thing that saddened me when I went to see that was the statement on the wall that some of his works are damaged and lost now because, you know, he didn't have any way to preserve them or something. And I walked through the exhibit, and it was just really, really powerful, some of his pictures. But I was just wondering about your thoughts on the preservation of black photographers' work.
Well, you know, the issues of preservation, I think, continue to be a problem, not just for photography, but painting and sculpture and, mm-hmm. and so forth. And so finding the proper archive mm-hmm. To store the work is an ongoing question. It's certainly one that I have right now. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do with the work? Where is it going to be stored? Where is it going to be treated properly?
Yeah.
And but it's an ongoing issue and an ongoing problem. There was some very exciting To Preserve a Legacy, a very interesting exhibition that circulated a few years ago that was very specifically about the preservation of African-American materials. That means that African Americans, too, I think, really need to step up to the plate and begin to give money to museums and institutions to make sure that the work is preserved properly.
Right.
It becomes a social responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that not only African Americans will, but Americans generally will step up to the plate and begin to support the arts that much more thoroughly, making sure that it is preserved for future generations. Because it's not just about a representation of black subjects that are important to a black audience,
mm-hmm.
right? This is a part of America's cultural heritage that
yeah.
we have to hold on to and
yeah.
preserve.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for the call. Other calls are welcome at 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You have talked about, I read a quote, it was virtually the same thing that you said yesterday in your talk about struggling to figure out who you were as an artist and what you were doing. And this was the quote about how your crew cried. You cried all day. You cried at work. You cried on the way home. You cried when you're working with your students. You cried when you got into bed at night. And have you stopped crying?
I did.
So you got to the point where you sort of felt comfortable about, or at least you felt like you knew what it was you were trying to do.
Well, you know, it's really true. I was so, you know, this thing that we do, this thing called art, takes an extraordinary toll on the body and on the mind. It's a difficult way to live a life. And it's very, very, very demanding. It's a demanding mistress, and exacting. And there's a period when I just simply, you know, that there are any number of influences. There are people that I admire, the last caller, people that I wanted to emulate, people that I wanted to be like. But I wasn't them. I was me. And so, what is unique about oneself, and how do you express that? But for me, it was an interesting turning point, because after doing all of this sort of, you know, this sort of soul searching and moving around the country and being upset and crying and trying to negotiate the who and what of myself, it was really an understanding that I was in deep search of a very particular voice, of my own specific voice, my own specific voicing. Who was this woman, Carrie Mae Weems? What did she feel? What did she know? What did she think? What could she make of those things? And the moment that I realized that I sounded like my mother, which was startling, was also the moment that I stopped crying. That it was simply this kind of coming together of emotional energies that that was profoundly illuminating, and I could then move on, knowing, I think, maybe in some way that this voicing came from someplace, that this voicing had a history, and that I simply needed to pay attention to that history, to its past, to its present, to its future, locating it. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it seemed to make a great difference in my life, understanding that there was my mother's voice and her blood running through me that made sense and made a certain kind of work possible. I did the Kitchen Table series right in the middle of that realization.
Yeah. Well, there is, in some of those photographs, there's a mother and a daughter. There's a triptych that these, I think it's at least three panels. Maybe there's some more of the mother and the daughter at the table. It seems that that's, that says a lot with those images. And so, well, you could one imagine that among the things you were thinking about was you being that little girl and that woman being your mother.
Well, you know, I saw this child. I've worked with several children over the years, and I always find them in the strangest way. And so one afternoon, again, I was in the process of working on Kitchen Table and photographing and, you know, stumbling through and trying to get everything right and trying to determine the precise mood and the location of things and people and objects within the scene. And I knew that I wanted to work with a child. I wanted to work with some earlier version of myself, some permutation of Carrie Weems as a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old. And so finally one afternoon, I'm driving down the street and I see this young girl sort of terrorizing a boy on her bicycle. She was like beating him with a stick or something. And I thought, there she is. There she is. That's her. And she looked exactly like me when I was like that age. She was fabulous. Yeah. And perfect. She was absolutely perfect. This girl comes into my home. Of course, I go over, I meet her mother and her other sisters, and I invite them over to my house. I explain to the mother what I'm trying to do, what I expect, what I'm going to pay. All those issues have to be decided. And we immediately began work, and this child was a natural. I just had to say, okay, so you're going to stand over here in that shot, and then you're going to stand over here in that shot, and then you're going to sit over here in that shot. And she was perfect. It was really kind of an amazing experience.
Yeah. And you didn't tell her, this is what I want you to be thinking about, this is what the story is. You just said just a bit.
We just kind of had this sort of wonderful directorial relationship. She sort of understood, okay, so if I'm standing here and I'm looking at you that way, then how are you going to respond to me? Now, this is about homework. Now, how do you negotiate homework when you're at... So, of course, there was some stuff, but not a lot. And I think that we shot that sequence. There are five images in all. I think we finished probably in about two and a half hours. It was just like magic.
Wow.
It was wonderful.
That just means setting them up and knocking them off, just
we
like that.
Just did
that
it.
Must have been so hard because you're in the picture. Did you try to set it up, go sit in front of the picture, take a picture,
that's
and then...
Right.
Then
that's right. It's deep focus. It's deep focus. I mean, you know, one of the things that I love about being an artist, and I do love being an artist, as tough as it is that I have an incredible amount of time to think about what it is that I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to make. But the process takes a very deep focus and the ability to concentrate very specifically on a goal. And so working with that child, for instance, that night, volatile, it meant that one simply has to be very, very focused. And so we were able to do it. And I'm very happy with the results, and so are they.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Thank you very much. I've been enjoying your conversation and have learned some things. But I am concerned because I think I am getting cynical. I know just enough about Photoshop to know how the photographs can be changed. And I have started looking at photographs, I've noticed very often, which I say to myself, how has this photograph been changed to give what the photographer wants to see, wants me to see, and how I should experience?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any suggestions as to how that we can separate these two things and be sure that we are getting the true feeling from the photographer?
I mean, I think probably are getting the true feeling from the photographer. It may be a truth that you might not be necessarily interested in, but it is, in fact, truth. I mean, photographs have often been manipulated in various ways. I think that the most important thing is, does the photograph represent a truth that seems true to you? And does it get at something that's important to you? That does it illuminate or reveal something that is true to your experience? And if it does that, I don't think it really matters if it's manipulated or not.
Well, I'll have to do some thinking about that.
Hmm.
I know there's a way in which we've, of course, thought about photographs for so long as being this objective truth. And suddenly, with all the new sort of digital technology that's available to us, we are, I think, finally sort of catching up with the reality that many photographers have known for a long time that photographs can be manipulated. And they often are. But I think perhaps, again, the thing to be much more concerned about is what the photograph means to you, whether it's manipulated or not. Does it get at some truth? Does it reveal something that you find important and or illuminating? I think that that's really the larger question that needs to be asked of contemporary photography at this point.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Right,
I'll
thanks.
Do some thinking about that.
Thanks
for
calling.
The call. Well, it seems that if we're talking about images that are made as art objects and images that are made as journalism, maybe they're different. Maybe the issues are different, at least in trying to figure out, well, what is it that the photographer is trying to tell me, and how much has he or she fiddled with things to produce that image. And in some cases, maybe it doesn't matter. If you look at a scene and you think, well, maybe I think it'd be better if we move that lamp over 3 inches.
I think you're right about that.
But there's a difference between that and...
Of course. I think that you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And so we're expecting a kind of artistic or rather journalistic truth from journalists. We don't always get it. Yeah. We don't always get it, but we are expecting that. We assume that, for instance, the photographs that are causing an enormous stir right now in this country, you know, these photographs of Iraqi prisoners being humiliated by American soldiers, we assume that those photographs are telling us something about the truth. They're not, of course, they're never going to tell us the whole truth, but they are certainly telling us something about the truth. And so, yes, I think that journalists do have another kind of obligation and one that I hope that they are paying more attention to. But again, there is no way that we can ever really know what has been manipulated and what has not. We can only bank on the truth of the journalist in that case. Mm. And that goes back to having a sense of one's own integrity and the ability to sleep with oneself at night.
I know that you in your life have been interested in a lot of different things and that you have said that at times you were interested. You thought maybe you would be an anthropologist. You were interested in that. I know that you're interested in folklore and actually have spent some time academically pursuing that. And those things do come out in the work. Let me ask you, maybe you can talk about that, about how it is you think those kinds of interests show up in the work.
Well, I mean, it's true. I thought that I was going to be an anthropologist. I loved anthropology and ethnology and folklore and biology. I mean, I was very interested in the world of science, the world of why things operated as they did, how the world came to be in its present form. And so I have always been interested in the sciences in some sort of way. And absolutely, I mean, I think that, you know, my interest in certain sites in Africa had to do with, in West Africa, certainly had to do with the sort of tangential interest that I still maintain in anthropology, though I'm not an anthropologist and that I don't sort of do scientific studies of places. And yet, my drive to look at places, to understand them, to understand something about the archaeology of a place and the architecture of a place is absolutely essential to me in the structure of the photographs. I did a whole series of works along the slave coast of West Africa. The archaeology and the architecture of the system of slavery was absolutely necessary for me to understand. It was absolutely necessary for me to understand the shape and the construction of these buildings. But really in order to make an artwork out of them that would illuminate them just that much more further. You know, that much deeper. So I've spent a long time, I'm interested in history. Those things guide me. Those things sort of move me through the process of work. They're the first place that I begin to do a level of investigation. And then I put it all aside and I run out into the world and try to make what I think I really need to make, responding as viscerally as possible to the structures that are in front of me, the cultural structures that are in front of me.
I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about some of the installations that you have done, as I think that the idea is pretty interesting, that what you have done is taken the images, photographs, some of them are archival, some of them are your own photographs, and they have been printed on big panels of fabric hung from the ceiling in a way so that visitors, people who go through the installation can walk up to them, can walk around them. And what's interesting is the fact that the material is sheer enough so that you see the picture that's printed on it, but you can also see through it. And you can do interesting things where you can hang the panels in ways so that you can stand in front of one and see that image. But you can also see one that's in back of it and one that's in back
that's
of that
right. That's right.
And
yeah.
layering up the images in a real interesting
it's
way.
It's like collage and montage hanging in
exactly.
the space.
So, how did you come on that idea of doing that?
You know, I have been, you know, I had really wanted to get off the wall. I didn't want to. I mean, I've done many, many different kinds of installations, and I didn't want to be on a wall anymore. I didn't want to experience the photograph or a photographic installation linearly. I want it to be able to move through it somehow. I want it to be able to move through the work of art, and I wanted the audience to engage with me in that kind of way, right? That they would be able to move through the work of art. What an idea, right? That we could move through the work of art, that we, in fact, could become participant, observer, part of the piece, in the piece, activating the piece, so that when you stand in it, right, someone looking from the outside of it would see you as a part of this work of art. So these ideas were very much going on. And so I was living in Europe. I'd been trying to figure this out for a number of years, trying to figure out how to print on various substrates and surfaces. And finally, in Berlin, leave it to the Germans to, like, you know, figure it out. They had figured out a really beautiful, beautiful process for printing on cloth, and I found them, and I went there, and then I wound up spending basically 3 years going back and forth, working on a number of different projects in this kind of way, using this sheer diaphanous material. Often the photographs coming out of different, in some instances, coming out of various archives. Going back to the caller's question again, the need to preserve our archives so that artists will have access to them, that intellectuals and scholars will have access to these materials, so that we can think about them in a new way in the future. So it was very important to do that, and then, of course, to make my own photographs in relationship to and include those as well in the installation. So it's been a good way of working, and of course those installations also involve sound as well. And in one case, I'm working with the composer James Newton, who did a really beautiful piece for Ritual and Revolution, and another visual artist, Ulysses Jenkins, who assisted me with sound for the Hampton Project. So they've been really wonderful ways of breaking out of the box. Mm-hmm. Breaking out of the box. And so then after I did that, I thought, well, you know, since they were sort of very filmic and cinematic, I thought, well, maybe now it's time to make some film and some cinema before I rush off to join the circus.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry.
No, you're kicking me out?
I'm afraid
so. I don't want to go.
Well, we could keep talking, but it's the end of my show.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Carrie Mae Weems. And people should go out and look. Go to the library. Go to wherever you can find art books. Look for her work, because it has been collected. Catalogs of some of these shows, and there are books that will give you an idea of her work, because it's really beautiful. Thanks again. Yeah,
thanks so much for inviting me. It's lovely.
Programs here on AM 580 made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design gemstone roundtables and conflict-free diamonds from Canada. Just before we go, a reminder that we have had a little change of our programming here. I'm sure we'll have more to say about it later, but apparently we have decided that tomorrow morning we're going to preempt some of our regular programming, and we'll be bringing you live coverage of testimony by Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, also Air Force General Richard Myers, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, before the Senate Armed Services Committee. We think that'll begin at about 10:30 tomorrow morning and last through a lot of the morning and maybe some of the afternoon. So you can tune in for that. Of course, right now, the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other.